CliffCentral.com. It is just after 7 o'clock, CliffCentral.com, the burning platform which is brought to you every week by Nando's. We're not afraid to get into the big issues of the day, the big issues of the week. This is like concentrated current affairs. You squeeze that lemon and you get the freshest, most sharp and tasty lemon zest right out of it.
Pungent.
Magic. Pungent as well.
Yeah, pungent. Don't forget pungent.
And this morning, Canton Pelé, who's our regular returning champion, is here with someone who I've been trying to get into the studio for some time. He's been so busy. He's traveling the country. He's got a Liberty Mobile, which he's driving outside. He is Big Daddy Liberty, Sihle Ngobese. You can find him on social media. So first of all, let's just welcome Sihle and find out what you've been up to. So you've been going around the country, as I said, and you've been talking to people about Liberty. Is there any interest in this subject, or are people more interested in free T-shirts?
Firstly, thanks for having me on, man. It's actually very good to be on the show.
See, last time I saw you was probably in Cape Town.
Yes.
4 years ago?
It's been a while, Herms. Yeah. And, look, again, thanks for having me on the show. Yeah, the thing about Big Daddy Liberty, the brand, the show that I run, you know, the Big Liberty Show is...
Yeah, this is online, right?
Absolutely.
People can find it on
Facebook,
media,
YouTube, right. Just search Big Liberty Show or Big Daddy Liberty, and you'll find me on there. But as the name suggests, I'm your favorite fat boy, Big Daddy, and I love liberty. I love freedom.
You're not a small, insignificant, fading flower.
Not at all. I was never Where's Wally on Halloween.
He's definitely not small. Can we just get perspective?
Hey, man. I enjoy what I do, and what I do is essentially advocate for freedom, the very thing that South Africans have never had. Whether you go back in time to colonial days, apartheid, or even today's regime of, you know, sort of trendy lefty type politicians, we've never been able to say as individuals, as families, that I own myself, I control, I'm able to govern what my family does. And, you know, I'm a person of, you know, as most South Africans are, you know, very God-loving individuals, family-orientated, and of course, by and large, law-abiding.
And you go around telling people essentially that they own their own labor, that they have the right that is given by the Constitution, and some people would say by God, to operate with freedom in the world.
Absolutely. As long as you're not harming the next person, you should be as free as you are.
So why would you need to do this? This seems to me like good stuff that everybody should be open to and accepting at some visceral level. We should all be thrilled to be part of a movement that would be like that. Are you popular, and why do you have to go around the country convincing people that liberty is a good thing?
That's a good question. Am I popular? Kind of, yes. to an extent. I'm not popular with the politicians, and I'm definitely not popular with the gaggle of leftists who prop them up. Why? Because I burst the myths that they often create, the myths that we need government essentially to control every aspect of our lives, that we need essentially some politician to tell you and Canton or me or our families where we can eat, sleep, who we can have sex with, the very thing, you know, that you and I would accept that in a free society, individuals should be able to make their own decisions about. So if you're the kind of person who enjoys controlling other people, who enjoys subjugating them, essentially enslaving them in a 21st century way, then you hate Big Daddy Liberty. I mean, who's this fat black guy talking about freedom and disturbing our nice little fiefdom that we have in this country where we steal from the very people that we control? So of course you'll hate me, but to the average individual, as a last gasp, to the average individual who's never heard these ideas and has grown up knowing that the state is some sort of godly figure that should control their lives, and the politicians, you know, a usual leftist iteration of them, should be their mommy or daddy, listen to me, they go, huh, I've never actually seen society in that way, tell me more. And that's what I think threatens the political establishment in this country.
You don't really fit into any of the boxes that people want to put you in, and I don't mean that as some kind of slur against your side.
I think the undertaker who actually handled my body is probably going, well, yeah, I'll see about that, Gareth.
But here's the thing about you is you don't really mind not fitting in, and you don't mind if people other you.
That's right.
Which is, to some people, the biggest fear in the world. In fact, much of what people on the left will say is that discrimination of any kind, the ability to other people, is just the most horrible thing that humans can do to each other. Yet, You've converted to Judaism.
Converting, yep.
Right, you are converting. You're going through that at the moment. It's a long process.
It's a good one for me.
No, sure. And you believe in you know, freedom, liberty, the free market. These are things that are not the usual.
Yeah.
How do you defend yourself against people who say that you are a traitor to the Zulus, a traitor to Ubuntu and the spirit of people doing things communally, that you are a traitor to African traditions because you've converted to Judaism, for example? How do you respond?
The Christian individuals who say that often.
I know. So what do you say to those people?
Well, firstly, the thing I say is I'm an individual, just like you are. And my ability to self-own, make decisions about my own lives, is an ability and a freedom I want to express and share with everybody else, including that individual who says that to me. So that any conflict you have in a society of 60 million South Africans is welcome. When I say conflict, I don't mean physical conflict, but like disagreements. You want to live in a society where we can disagree on issues. The issue becomes, though, what sort of rules, or rather, what sort of society do you create or live in that facilitates that in a peaceful, non-aggressive way? So if you want to call me a fat traitor, Uncle Tom, coon, all the things that...
You heard it all, right?
Absolutely. Just go onto my social media timeline and you'll see exactly what they call me.
Who are the people who are saying this to you?
No, that's the interesting part.
Because a lot of people have manners and they wouldn't treat another person like this. Who are the people who call you like a coon or a Uncle Tom?
Ah, but you see, social media emboldens the coward, doesn't it? In everyday life, when I'm out in the streets talking to people, most polite, even if they disagree. Sorry?
Is coon still a thing?
I've just heard that word for the first time since I last heard it in the 80s.
But you know the really funny thing is, they listen to these American sort of cultural, you know, the genesis of all this is sort of the American pop culture and American political culture, and the racial tensions there, and they translate those exact same terms, derogatory or otherwise, here in South Africa, and they just don't work.
They don't fit.
What about an individual? What about a Zulu Jewish libertarian, if you will, who advocates for all individuals, including the very black individuals that they claim to represent? What about him saying that all people should have freedom to be exactly who they are threatens you? What is it about that message that actually threatens, unless, of course, you are a nefarious figure looking to control those people for insidious reasons?
Or someone who's just shackled by their own inferiority complex or insecurity.
Absolutely. I mean,
I think a lot of wokeism is that, you know?
Here's what I said last night, I think, on social media. And I said, you know, the woke lot, the trendy lefties, these identitarians, people who trade on race, identity, gender, all that blah, blah, blah. They are the separate but equal individuals of our time. They are the individuals who, back in the 60s, would have called the Jim Crow type segregationists. They are the individuals who, back in the 40s, 48 onwards, would have called the apartheid type separatists.
They would have been Favut's constituency.
He would have loved them. He would have literally been like, hey man, let's have a bribe because you're my people. So of course they hate me. Of course they hate the guy who says you don't have to subscribe to some sort of group identity which you don't necessarily feel akin to if you're an individual.
All right. I think what you're doing is fascinating because mostly I really like people who break the mold. I like people who don't allow others to push them around and who stand up for themselves, even if I disagree with those things.
Absolutely.
Because surely that's the point of life. You get to a stage in your life where you know yourself. You know what you're prepared to tolerate and what you're not. And you just don't take shit from people. So
that's right.
I think that's a very good thing. We can get into biography, but I want you to join Canton and I now and everybody else, 0797482090. Look at some of the current affairs in the world. And we can always get you back for a proper interview.
Absolutely,
some stage.
Why not?
You know, unpack your life a little bit because it's fascinating. First things first, you two. And by the way, you can join in if you have anything that you want us to discuss. Last week, Canton got questions about Russia. Whatever you think you need us to discuss, go into, have opinions on, analyze, go ahead. There's a great article by R.W. Johnson that was being circulated around this week. And I think it's from Politics Web. It's long, but it's very detailed, and R.W. Johnson is, I think, one of the finer, if not the finest, analyst and commentator when it comes to South African politics. He says things that are very uncomfortable for many of us to hear, but so far he's been pretty much spot on about it.
He's been consistently accurate and the decades that I've been reading Bill Johnson, yes.
So if you two don't mind, if you've read what he had to say, can you give us a synopsis or a précis of what he had to say about South Africa in 2020 and the ANC in particular, this kleptocracy that he called it, and what the response has been, either from just the two of you or from other people? Who wants to go first?
Sure. I'm actually just diving into the thing as we speak.
So you haven't read it properly yet.
No. You know, I want to find some quotable quotes.
Okay,
there was some
cool.
Brilliant stuff.
Well, I'll start off by saying that what he did is he sketched the scenario for liberation movements across Africa and how so many of them failed when they came into government because there are people in those movements who really are just in it for themselves. They're in there to enrich themselves, you know, typical banana republic stuff. And he used the word kleptocracy, which, you know, a kleptomaniac is someone who goes and steals things. And a kleptocracy, anything with ocracy in it, is a form of government. Yeah. Aristocracy, democracy, all of those words have to do, oligarchy. These are all words that have to do with the way people are governed.
So here's a quotable quote. BEE itself, the Black Economic Empowerment, is a form of legalized price gouging. Mm. And non-market preferences with the costs invariably passed on to the public in one way or the other. Promotion to high office of unqualified people so that they receive money and status far beyond their merits is not a dissimilar abuse.
Is that a very dangerous opinion in South Africa?
No, I don't think it's dangerous. I think that a number of us have been saying it for a number of years now, apart from the mainstream political parties, because you know, even getting the DA to back down on the idea of race-based affirmative action.
Pulling teeth.
Yeah, exactly. It's like pulling
teeth.
All right, so what did you think of the argument?
I mean, it's crazy. Look, the thing about R.W. Johnson, he's not wrong, and he does echo a lot of key thinkers who have looked at the African case insofar as what has happened since post-liberation. Really good book on this is The State of Africa by Martin Meredith. I do encourage people to read that. But the script is, you'd realize the script is almost typecast. It's the same everywhere, from Ghana in the 50s to right up to us in the mid-90s. You have a situation where the key thinkers who influence your liberation politicians aren't your liberty-loving individuals like your Mills, etc., etc., but rather the red-in-tooth-and-claw communist-type ideologies. And unfortunately for a lot of these liberation movements, and us included, the ideas are, I mean, all you need to do is look at the 20th century to realize just how appalling the ideas are.
And just how intellectually bankrupt they are, apart from the damage they've done to actual
human
beings.
Absolutely vapid.
They've been debunked and disproved at every level, in every incarnation.
But the one thing about them that we've never really zoomed in on and focused on is the fact that these ideas allow for the sort of corruption that gets a fat cat, if you will, and if it, it allows...
You're allowed to use the word fat.
Yeah, I was about to say, hey man, like I probably triggered some sort of like, you know, body positivity people. I hate those people. It's okay to be fat. No, it's not. It is terrible for your health. Anyway, I digress. But if you really pay attention to what we've experienced and endured as Africans, it's always been politicians who are power hungry, and of course, with the power comes the trappings of, you know, stealing from the public purse. The script, as I was saying, is always been the same, Gareth, and South Africa is no different. The problem with us is there is such a high base that they're working off of. I mean, whatever you want to say about apartheid, and yes, I'm going to tread into the Helen Zille territory here. Whatever you want to say into apartheid and colonialism, those two systems in this country invested a lot of infrastructure in South Africa. Mm. Yes, it was for a minority group.
So there's just what R.W. Johnson said there is essentially, I don't like to paraphrase you, but I remember this line and I thought it was quite powerful. He says, there's just more to steal in South Africa than there was in Ghana or in Zimbabwe or anywhere else.
Yes, exactly.
And that is why the trappings of power.
So exactly. The only reason that the party's been going on as long as it has for the ANC is because we had more for them to steal. But now the money's running out.
Yep.
Well, but there's our pension funds, Gareth, and I keep mentioning this.
Yeah, of course.
Prescribed assets.
That's the next frontier, isn't it? But again, you've got to take two steps back and almost where we began this conversation around what is the role of a government and the role of a politician? Do you see a politician as someone who should have all the power in society, makes all the decisions, and essentially controls all aspects of people's lives? Because if you see a politician and you agree that that should be your politician, then there's nothing wrong with that politician saying, hey, I need your pension in order to prop up some sort of vanity project that I control. Consider important, not you the citizen, not you the individual, not you the mom or the father in the family, but I the politician. So it's about the citizen. What vision do you have for this type of government, and what relationship do you want to have with government? Unless you answer that question, nothing changes. You can change the deck chairs, whether it's the EFF or the ANC or even the DA. All of them are some form of leftist statist iteration, and it's up to citizens to actually say, no, I want to reclaim the power, I want to reclaim the resources, put them into my hands as the family individual.
There was a great story this week, which you've just made me think of, about the people in Harry Smith who decided...
Yeah, what a fabulous story.
I knew you would like this, Canton. Mm-hmm. They decided to take control of a municipality that's completely defunct and bankrupt.
Yep.
And they decided to reinstitute their own water systems. They actually had ordinary members of the community in Harry Smith go out and with wrenches and screwdrivers and hammers fix the pipes.
That's right.
Start up the systems that have been left neglected and unmaintained. And they've done it. They've got it working again, in spite of their local municipality.
And often, you know, with the local municipality trying to stop them. And this is the thing about, you know, some of the philosophers who I really enjoy quoting. One of them often says, you know, good people break bad laws. And those individuals were breaking all sorts of municipal finance and municipal systems acts and blah, blah, blah. But essentially, it was people who got together and said, hey, I'd rather break the law and have a service and have a community enjoy the service as opposed to waiting for some government official who really doesn't care about me and will get a salary anyway to pontificate and stand in front of me and make all sorts of promises about service delivery. But I wanted to come back to that one because I actually will be traveling to Harry Smith. There's an episode I'm currently producing called Water Socialism as I look at this issue. as I look at this issue broadly, because it's not just Harry Smith, it's all over the country. You know, in a previous life, if I can call it that, I was in government, in a Western Cape government, and we had day zero threats at that time. But that's where it sort of really piqued my interest. That if a city like Cape Town can nearly run out of water, effectively it did run out of water, then what about small towns where they don't have the sort of good systems and the good finances to be able to say, look, let's maybe take money from here and deal with an emergency. So there is something fundamentally wrong around how we've organized government and given it the power over important things like water and electricity and the like.
I've got to ask both of you, because you're both such libertarians and you believe in less government. Water is really a good example of where you do need some government, because water is a resource which everybody has to use responsibly. It has to be administered in some supranational way, because if you just have people taking water, I mean, like, our rivers are all polluted. You can't use them for drinking water or any of that stuff.
Why are they polluted?
Well, yes, because it's been administered very badly.
And by the state.
Yes,
as soon as something
but
is earned
don't
by the
you
state.
Agree, but don't you agree that the state needs to have some role in water, for example? We have dams. We don't all own the, none of the dams are, as far as I know, the big ones anyway, privately owned. And these are the major source for urban areas. Not everyone in urban areas has boreholes. No one can afford to do that. So there needs to be some form of an accountable system put in place which can administer people's rights to have water. The right to have water. I mean, this stretches back to the dawn of time. If you don't have water, you die. Right?
Well, you have the right to access to water, but any right that someone else has to provide for you is not a right. Just think about this, all right? I can't have an obligation on your part, Gareth, that you need to provide me with water.
Yes, but then how is this managed?
Well, you have exactly the same scenario right now. Where
it's greatest
not
philosophy. So how should it be managed?
Well, for starters, we could have a scenario exactly like what's going down in Harry Smith, where essentially you have a community that comes together. And there's no coercion involved. There's no extraction of ratepayers' money that goes into the pockets of officials rather than going directly to fixing the problem. It's a group of people who actually get together and say, we're actually going to fix this water supply.
But in the city of Johannesburg, for example, should we, God forbid, run dry on all the dams around Joburg and the Vaal particular, in particular.
Well, Joburg's a particular case because none of our water actually comes from Joburg. So right. all of our water actually gets... it starts off in the Lesotho Highlands, heads across to the Sterkfontein Dam, which is the catchment area, flows from there to the Vaal Dam, and from the Vaal Dam it flows across to us. Now, just think of the logistics of if suddenly... let's say some smart ass actually decided to head across to Clarence, which is where the Lesotho Highlands pipeline actually breaks ground. And let's say they took it out with a bomb. All right, what happens to the city of Johannesburg?
That's what I'm asking.
The city of Johannesburg shuts down sooner or later. And at that point, what I expect is going to happen, if you think of all of the rivers that currently flow through Johannesburg, people will then have to actually start finding ways of actually processing that water. For example, I live in Buklu, and the Yukske flows right through there.
Sorry, just say it properly. It's Buklu.
or Buklu, as most of the local Zimbabweans refer to it.
Yeah, so yes. What happens there?
Well, nothing. That's the point. But but the Yukske is never dry.
No.
Okay, and really all it takes is, if you just take the little community that I happen to be in, we could very easily set up a process where we're actually taking water from the Yukske and processing it and making it available to everyone in that community. Now consider just how many of these rivers flow through Johannesburg. People in Johannesburg are clueless as to the number of rivers that we actually have. Let me tell you this, people. If you actually have a traffic jam wherever you happen to be in Johannesburg, it's because you happen to be crossing a river. So, say, for example, you're coming from Blairgowrie down into Craighall via Jan Smuts. You're crossing a river. It narrows to two lanes, and that's the reason why traffic slows to a standstill. You're going along Witkoppen, you're ending up crossing about three rivers in that process.
But isn't Johannesburg the only city, one of the few cities, rather, not the only one, but one of the few cities in the world that isn't built on a major waterway?
It's not major, but there's certainly enough water.
There are a few rivers.
There's substantial rivers flowing.
And we have massive groundwater reservoirs.
We do have massive groundwater reservoirs,
because of the mining, and because
of
the mining, we have huge holes and caverns under us as well that are filling up with water.
Exactly. But if you consider right now that essentially the reason why we are importing our water, and we literally are importing our water from Lesotho, and in so doing, propping up a corrupt government that happens to be in Lesotho. Now, just consider for a second the business opportunities that would be available just in terms of providing water from all of the rivers that are flowing through Johannesburg. You've got the Yukske,
Yukske down the road from where you live.
Yes.
If your community got together, you'd still need to amass some kind of money to make some system in place which would purify the water, filter the water, distribute the water, dig, you'd have to put pipes in. This is a big issue.
The pipes,
they're there?
They're already there, and we're paying for them because that's where the municipal water supply comes from. So effectively, all we need is a big-ass tank that's actually capable of supplying the area.
A reservoir, essentially, which a community can fund by... Yeah. Pitching together and putting it together. I mean, this myth, we also need to burst this myth that somehow poor individuals, and I'm not saying you're necessarily saying this, but you commonly hear this retort whenever you say like a community can get together and do things on their own. Poor people are just as capable and just as able to, when they recognize the need for something, band together and make it happen.
Yeah, it's that soft bigotry of low expectations.
Absolutely.
That drives me crazy.
Again, Harry Smith is a good example. Grahamstown, by the way, if you're paying attention to what's happening down there, is also a good example of this. The problem is, if you have a state that literally says, no, don't do anything, wait for me to do something, worse yet, I will disenfranchise you by taxing you heavily so that you don't have much in the way of any form of disposable income to do as you wish with, then of course individuals will say, look, fine, let's leave it to the father figure that is government to do things for us. Even though people themselves, if you talk to, and this is the thing about my show, which I like, I don't talk to the influencers and the politicians and the famous people. I talk to ordinary South Africans, the guy in Pofadder who doesn't even have access to mainstream media, and I ask him questions around his life and what he thinks can guarantee his ability to self-own and look after his family. And those individuals are very reasonable. They're actually reasonable people.
And
they don't
resourceful
believe.
People.
Absolutely.
Right?
Like, you have to be resourceful in Pofadder. It's in the middle of the desert. My God. Have you ever never played golf in Pofadder, by the way, guys. Check out the golf course in Pofadder. There are no greens. Okay? Essentially, the way in which they created greens at the golf course in Pofadder is that they flattened the sand and then they poured oil onto it.
That's a green.
That's a green.
A phenomenal thing. Just quickly, a message from someone who says, Sitle, you're amazing. You inspire me. And hope you go shaking so many more people up. God bless you and continue to speak your truth. And then someone else saying, what is the best alternative? This is from Kuo Cho, who says, what's the best alternative to BEE? Having given it some thought, I've accepted that perhaps a merit-based system, particularly in the employment space, will exclude the majority of black people in the workplace. That's what Kucha says. Do you want to take her on?
No, it's actually a very simple equation. Why look at race when you can look at actual need? If a poor person is poor and has no access to opportunity, then give them an empowerment, or empower them, excuse me, based on the fact that they're poor and they don't have access. So, simply put, if you removed race and put in place a BEE that recognizes poverty. In other words, if you're poor, I will make sure you have a quality education, the means to a good healthcare system, a safe neighborhood to live in, et cetera, et cetera. I can go down the line in terms of the sort of enabling opportunities, we call them in economics, that allow an individual to escape poverty, get opportunity and earn income. If I focus on helping poor people, then invariably in a society like South Africa, you'll be helping mostly black South Africans because of our history and where we come from and essentially why, you know, the vast majority of poor people in this country are black. Yes, no one disagrees with this, but if you focus actually on helping poor people, you then also cut out this habit that we see with BEE of benefiting privileged black individuals, people. So for instance, without sort of mangling what I'm trying to say here, because I want to say a lot in one sentence, BE right now is great for those black individuals who are actually quite privileged. If you went to Hillcrest High School or Michael House or St. Stithians, I think is the one here in Johannesburg.
Don't disparage poor Mbulelo.
You know, if you went to these schools, I don't see why you need to be a beneficiary of empowerment, especially if your parents, for example, are educated professionals, high income earners, etc.
Or politically connected.
Which is invariably what happens when you focus on race. You can pervert the system to benefit those individuals at the expense of poor black individuals. Why is it that a poor black person needs to live vicariously through me as a middle class black person? In other words, that poor chap who sits on the side of the road with a sign saying I'm a plumber or electrician, please hire me for the day, watches me driving my nice fancy bucky past him, and what is he supposed to think? Oh, at least he's doing well as a black person, I can live through him. Of course not. He deserves every opportunity to be as middle class as I am and as you are, Gareth. And the best way you do that is focus your empowerment policies on helping poor people, not a certain race. That's the least, or rather, that's the best way to actually empower South Africans. Focus on poverty and socioeconomic need and not race.
All right, let's talk about something that everyone has been quietly, because it hasn't really broken out into the mainstream media as a discussion, but it's been going on as part of the opinion columns in the last couple of days. This issue around Daniel Friedman and The Citizen.
No.
You know what I'm talking about? So apparently SANEF has expressed concern, that's the South African National Editors Forum, over a growing trend of death threats and social media harassment by journalists, by right-wing groups and their supporters.
Yeah, I find it quite fascinating that they're actually singling out right-wing groups. I want to know where SANEF has actually done their research and where their data is actually coming from.
It's the same SANEF.
I understand that I'm one of the people who actually tweeted support of Daniel Friedman, even though I think he's a dick.
Explain.
Well, free speech is free speech. Okay, it doesn't matter how repulsive the person is. And trust me, I think of Daniel Friedman as being a particularly repulsive individual. But
by the way, for the record, we did invite Daniel Friedman on the show. He did not get back to us. He's been here before. Deep Fried Man is the same guy as Daniel Friedman, who is the Citizen's digital editor. He's been in various spats with people over the last year or two. He seems to have opinions that have inflamed a certain sector of the population. These people have been called right-wing by his supporters, Daniel Friedman's supporters, and his detractors are saying he is a left-wing woke identity politician.
And this is where I chime in. Exactly that. The thing about Daniel and how I really read this entire situation and how cheeky that sign-up statement actually is that you're essentially painting a whole group of people that, Daniel did offend, namely Afrikaans-speaking South Africans, as inherently somehow being right-wingers. And that's the sort of sleight of hand that I took offense to, if anything. Lol, me taking offense. You know, and it's this thing that we've done in this country of grouping people, and based on what sort of identity you have, I'll ascribe certain features of you. So if you are a white Afrikaner male, then surely you must be a right winger, and surely you're the individual, or rather the group, that is harassing Daniel Friedman, the poor left wing Jewish guy who just, he didn't know what he was saying, and you know, he's not just the victim of these hateful people. No, he's not. He has agency. He should at least take full responsibility for what he said. And what he said online, at least the tweets that I saw, was literally typecast a whole group of people who then took exception to that. So it's not that right wingers are attacking him, and that very well may be the case. Actually, I'm sorry, let me just quickly double back there, but it may very well be that some right wingers took exception to what he's saying. But the large majority of people I've seen take exception to his comments were actually Afrikaners who felt maligned by his comments. So he should take responsibility for that and not hide behind his employer, or worse yet, Sanef, who, by the way, much to be done.
Well, this is the same Sanef who have raised objections to the EFF so often, harassing journalists. It's almost as if they think journalists are special.
Let's just talk about Sanef for a second.
Yeah.
Okay. And the thing is that most people who are tuned in right now are probably not old enough to remember where Sanef actually came from.
So give us the history.
So the history of Sanef very briefly is that when we had the dawn of democracy, at that time, you know, the media, the mainstream media, which was an extremely powerful thing back in the day, because newspapers were a credible source of information and people used to buy them. But at the time, the editors of those newspapers were predominantly white. And with the dawn of democracy, they wanted, as usual at that time, the academics were trying to engineer a scenario where media was becoming more representative of what was happening in general. So at that time, there were two main bodies. There was the Conference of Editors. And the Conference of Editors was literally editors. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you had to be an editor of a newspaper, not a deputy editor, not a sub-editor or any of that. You had to be the person who was actually running the particular media house. And what that meant was that when you spoke with authority because you could speak for that particular publication. Mm. So come the dawn of democracy, the Conference of Editors is overwhelmingly white because that was the nature of newspapers at the time. And they said, well, let's now form a new body, and we'll call it the South African National Editors Forum, and we'll merge the Conference of Editors into this. The problem, of course, was that there was not enough representativity on this. So there was an organization at the time that was the Black Journalists Forum, and which got merged into the Conference of Editors as well. But there was still a problem in terms of representativity. So they opened up membership in SANEF to the academics. If you happen to be teaching journalism, then you ended up being a person who could then be part of the South African National Editors Forum. And since then, for the past 25-plus years, the agenda of the South African National Editors Forum has been set by the academics or people who are in the journalism training business. And it is in no way representative of what actually goes down in the actual media house. And that's why you see these lapses creeping in where they're suddenly referring to critics as right-wingers with no journalistic integrity going into that statement whatsoever. Everything that they are talking about is based entirely on their prejudices. Now, currently what they are doing is they have on their website, SANEF has launched an inquiry into media ethics with a panel of commissioners headed by retired Judge Kathleen Satchwell, including panelists Nikiwa Bikicha and Richam Kondo. The aim of this inquiry is to investigate what went wrong with some of our journalism in recent years and how we can fix these gaps and loopholes so that trust and alliances between us and the public can be built. Well, the reason why we've had this breakdown is precisely because of the fact that you numbnuts have been dictating the path of journalism. We tossed out accuracy, we tossed out objectivity, we tossed out fairness, all of those things that were pillars of journalism for decades, suddenly feelings became more important than facts. And it all drills down to Sanef. So the point at which Sanef then started raising concerns about my purported censorship at ENCA. Let's just get this straight, guys. The reason why I didn't bother responding to you is because I actually don't believe that you have the agency to question my decisions. Mm. Because none of you guys who are sitting up there are real journalists. I don't care if Kathy Satchfield's a retired judge. Okay, she has never written a headline.
Yeah.
She certainly provided sources for headlines.
And that's the funny thing. I think you're spot on, Canton. And I think you're referring to the media ethics and credibility inquiry.
I remember
sort of seeing that a month ago or so. And I remember thinking, but if you're going to do this, then you've got to go the full Monty, so to speak. Well, this morning. Anyway, you've actually got to go the whole nine yards to an extent. Really? Another metaphor?
Yeah.
Okay, third one is a charm.
Would you
just
like
kidding.
A third one?
the whole
hog. Let's do that.
You know, I'm Jewish. The hogs and me, kosher dog. Come on now.
Don't touch the hog.
Hey, man. Look, the one thing you would expect them to at least be quite frank about is this growing specter. And again, this is my opinion, and I at some stage I'll do some sort of episode to sort of prove what I'm saying. Of these activists who parade as journalists. And you see it a lot on issues when, and I think you're spot on, Campbell, in saying the loss of objectivity. You'll spot it when there is an issue that maybe a particular journalist or news anchor self-identifies with passionately, and suddenly the whole news item becomes about what their view is of this issue, parading, of course, as objective. And I've got some examples to name, but I just don't have time, I'm assuming.
No, we got time. Go for it.
You know, just very recently, what I'll do, I won't name names, but it is at your old news channel, ENCA, and I think they were doing a feature on now watch me sort of forget the actual issue itself. Yes. They're doing a feature on the Belofta boss saga, where essentially the venue, the owners of it
that didn't want to do a gay wedding.
Absolutely, which right. I think they're well within their right to do that, because they have the freedom to associate with who and who not.
And gay couples have the freedom to take their very hard-earned money elsewhere.
Elsewhere, absolutely. If someone is discriminating
don't
against
reward
you,
reward them for their bigotry, but at the same time, you don't get to force them to have you.
We're on the same page. But I really wanted to come back to this journalist who then does this opening monologue, sort of introducing the fact that they're going to focus on the story, and the entire thing was, yes, it was dressed as being objective, but you could just hear that they are about to grind out a narrative that literally suits their particular agenda, because this particular individual himself might be gay or whatever the case may be. I don't really know. I can't infer that. But you could hear it, and any South African listening to that news piece would have gone, I'm not sure if this is going to be objective. I'm not sure if I'm going to get facts here. I'm definitely going to get a narrative, though. At the end of this, I'm going to know where this anchor stands, and there's going to be some sort of faux outrage that I'm going to be asked to join in the name, of course, of being an objective news piece. And that's where I think a lot of us who watch the news and mainstream media are beginning to go, what is Sanef really doing then if these sort of things are not stamped out and even called out quite honestly by them?
In 1998, Gareth, there was an inquiry. It was either 98 or 99. There was this inquiry into racism in the media, which again, a lot of people will probably not remember. And at that time, I actually co-authored the submission that was made on behalf of what was at the time ETV. And our submission was actually very clear that if you practice the essence of journalism, which is accuracy, objectivity, and fairness, it is actually impossible for the media to be racist or in any way biased. So it's very simple. If you get the facts right, you don't take sides, and you don't try and inject things into the story to influence anyone's opinion, then you're incapable of actually having any medium that can be considered to be racist. This is something that is hugely unpopular, because everyone works on the assumption that there are hidden agendas at play. But yes, but the agendas come from the individuals who actually happen to be at all media organizations around the world. And the way in which you put a stop to this rubbish is you actually enforce the rules of getting your facts right and not taking sides. Mm. And it's not difficult. So suddenly this entire rubbish about media ethics, you know, headed by a panel of commissioners. No, actually all you need to do is actually just get every single journalist in the country to actually sign a code of conduct that says that I'm not pushing a particular agenda and I'm not taking money from anyone.
Mm.
And I just simply do that.
Yeah.
So a lot of them will resist doing that.
It's quite a lot to ask of some journalists, though. Something came up this morning, and it's quite a general discussion, but it has international implications and local ones. We see, for example, what's going on in Angola at the moment, or with the former Angolan regime, Isabel dos Santos, who was the daughter of the former president of Angola. They're going after her for money that she illicitly obtained during her father's regime in Angola, and she was for a while the richest woman in Africa.
Look, I want to just on a climate at that point, you know, I think we should avoid using the word illicitly. It was certainly as a result of nepotism.
Sure.
But I'm pretty clear that nearly all of the deals that she was involved in just happened to be legal. It just happened to be legal within the framework of the government
of Angola's
at the time.
Sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah. So illicit.
Well, it's like, okay, yeah. So for example, what
everyone knows that Duduzane Zuma actually earned his millions legally.
Sure, but these are the problems people have. So we have in various countries, you take Angola, which is a banana republic. We take South Africa, which certainly has a 90% chance of being included in the basket of banana republics. And Duduzane Zuma, who you mentioned earlier. We see Hunter Biden in a country which is not regarded as a banana republic, but has those tendencies. Hunter Biden, a guy who's totally
unqualified. You are so going to get cancelled now by speaking about Hunter Biden.
So this is a guy who had no experience in oil and gas and ended up being the front man for American involvement in a company called Burisma, which involved the vice president, his father, in some sort of a strong-arming of his son into that position, and a nice big fat salary, too.
$50,000 a month?
Right.
Crazy.
What is wrong with people in the 21st century that we're still allowing this kind of nepotism by politicians and their hopeless children? Hopeless. Hmm? Children who none of us would employ, right? How are we still... This is happening across the board, from America to Angola to South Africa and many others. Hmm. How is this still happening?
Call it evolutionary. Okay, right. I know that this is actually a something that is highly controversial. But think about it, okay?
This is you protecting your offspring.
It's you protecting your offspring, which ultimately is the goal of every single species on the planet. And you're protecting your gene pool. And really what we need to be doing as society is putting in place checks and balances to mitigate against that. Obviously, we don't want unfair discrimination against particular people just because they have
parents,
sins of the father and so forth. But at the same time, you need to ensure that you do have things like due process in place. And the difficulty that we have right now in terms of Isabel dos Santos, in terms of Hunter Biden, in terms of Duduzane Zuma, is that all of the stuff was done within the current legal framework of those respective territories. And the discussion that really needs to be held is how do you actually mitigate against that? The way in which you do that is transparency.
Mm.
And if anything, right now, you know, Trump has been probably the most transparent person out there. You know, there's nothing obscure whatsoever. He says, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
No quid pro quo. Except this one. Yeah. All right. Let's just talk about Zweli Mkhize, because he's under fire for appointing his niece, Sibusi Siwe Zulu, who comes with some baggage. She has misappropriated funds during her time at the PIC, which is such a shadowy organization.
Yep.
The Public Investment Corporation, which takes those very pension funds that Canton was talking about, and all kinds of other investments by ordinary South Africans. Mm. It's administered by the state, the PIC. Apparently, during her tenure there, she's supposed to have misappropriated funds. Although she faced no criminal charges, just like everyone else who steals from the public in South Africa, there's never any criminal charges. She left her role with the corporation in acrimonious circumstances. The fact that she may have some sort of influence over the impending national health insurance scheme has spooked some people on the opposition benches.
Well, here's what
it doesn't take much to spook people.
Well, I was about to say, here's what should scare you the most. the very same individual, in this case the Minister of Health, who seeks to appropriate even more power for themselves under this national health insurance, the power, of course, to decide these individuals who will be deciding your life when it comes to healthcare. The same individual who's saying, give me the power to pick these individuals, in his own office has picked his niece.
Yeah.
Arguably, she may be qualified, whatever the case may be, but he's already set a precedent for how he makes his decisions in who he picks and who he doesn't. And now he's saying, give me the power to make the decisions around your A to Z when it comes to your healthcare. And don't focus on the fact that I'll put my family member in this 1 million rand a year job. don't worry, I won't do that when it comes to the NHI itself. I'll somehow be this virtuous individual when it comes to that, and I'll pick the best individuals to run your healthcare. Now, if you're a South African parent and you're worried about the healthcare of not only yourself but your family, and you're hearing politicians say, we want to take control of your healthcare decisions, do you really trust that individual who makes a corrupt, or rather a nepotistic, which is also corrupt, decision such as this one? Do you really trust that individual with giving them the power over your healthcare? And the answer should be no. And it comes back to that previous point we're making, Canton, actually, around what do you do? Yes, accountability and transparency is one thing, but also limit the power of the state, limit the power of the politicians. If these people didn't really matter that much, then... if these people didn't really matter that much, they didn't have that much power, then whoever they pick into these positions would be irrelevant, because the very nature of the state itself would be limited and wouldn't have much control over people's lives. The problem is we've made governments these big monsters that are involved in everything, from your business to who you sleep with to whatever. And whatever they do then, even if it's corrupt, it has a massive influence on your life. So it's about, again, I always come back to this. It's about how we, the citizens, view the relationship, our relationship and the role of the state. If you want it to be big and bulky, then yes, these sort of decisions harm you the worst.
That's absolutely spot on. Because in fact, if you want to summarize what the power of the state is, the power of the state is the ability to spend your money. Mm. Now that's the essential power of the state.
Their ability to spend your money.
Yeah. So if you look in terms of Hunter Biden and the Ukrainians. The power of the state in the case of the U.S. is to control the flow of U.S. taxpayer money to go to the state of Ukraine. And so ultimately what happens is, because for the Ukrainians, in order to be able to receive funding from what was then the Obama administration, they need to be nice to a person who happens to be associated peripherally with that administration. But again, it's a question of, hey, you know, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. But fundamentally, if you limit the ability of government to spend your money, that's how you take power away from them. And that's where the transparency comes from.
But
how exactly does the money get spent? You follow the trail every step of the way.
Interesting you say that. So you guys seem to reduce the state's ability to affect the individual citizen, is what I'm picking up. But the countries we look to replicate are what, your Norway's, Singapore. Without tremendous state intervention, great things aren't possible, because what you need is good governance. We must separate between bad governance. We mustn't make the mistake.
This is the idea of the capable state, right?
But you need, otherwise you cannot have anything work without strong state intervention. And whether you like Singapore, you like, otherwise give me an example where you haven't seen strong state intervention and it's working in the 21st century context. It'd be interesting to hear both your take.
Well, let me give you a very practical example. Okay, if you take we need to back away from this idea that the concept of the nation state is what should be defining us as a species.
Governance and the nation state is not the same thing.
But no, but I'm talking about the concept of a nation state in of itself. The concept of a nation state is it's an aberration if you think about it. And it's essentially as a result of wars that were fought in centuries past. Mm-hmm. And so we've had these arbitrary lines that have been drawn up on maps around the world. And particularly in the case of this continent, if you take a look at the political maps, most of the boundaries are straight lines that actually cut across.
And they were capriciously decided by a bunch of people who we've forgotten the names of mostly.
Absolutely right. Now, if you move away from the idea of the nation state as the entity that...
By the way, when they aren't straight lines, they're rivers.
Yes, absolutely right.
And people on both sides of those rivers sometimes speak exactly the same language, have the same ancestors, do the same things, but for some... bizarre reason, just because they were on that side of the river at that time.
Well, it's like Budapest is actually two cities. It's Buda and Pest. They just happen to be on either side of the same river.
Exactly.
Yeah. In fact, your uncle's on the other side.
But going back to your point, if you take a view that the nation state is not something that we should be aspiring to, in fact, you drill down to what are the capable functioning units. Now, if you take South Africa as an example of that, South Africa is the perfect example because we have parts of South Africa that work. What are the parts that work? Johannesburg works, Cape Town works, Durban works. Those are thriving economic hubs, and if you look in terms of the economic growth that has been tracked in those three city centers, you will find that we've actually been in positive growth territory, even through the worst of the Zuma years. What is in fact happening is that the money that is generated by those three centers gets stolen by national government and then gets poured into propping up the rest of the country, which frankly should not be surviving on the basis of money that's stolen from other parts of the country.
After they take their cut, by the way.
Yeah. So if you have a scenario where Johannesburg and, you know, people in the greater Johannesburg area suddenly decided to secede and set up a Republic of Gauteng, it would be a thriving functional state. Ditto in the case of Cape Town, ditto in the case of eThekwini. So that is the response to that. We have to move away from the idea that you need a state that's actually going to make things work. Drill down into smaller functional units. Switzerland, classic example of this, where each of the cantons is essentially self-governing. And all of them then actually pool resources when it comes to matters of national interest, such as defense.
But they do so on almost a voluntary basis.
It is.
So if I want to supply 100 men with guns, but you only want to supply 50, then that's fine. Then, you know, that I take a slightly bigger share of the spoils, for example.
Well, if we essentially get ourselves out of this idea of needing to empower the state to make decisions, then we can do things. U.S. is another great example. You know, the fact is that the states have a high degree of autonomy in terms of how they run their economies. And what happens is that money then tends to flow to those areas that are actually going to be most conducive to actually generating more money.
Which is why Texas is doing so well and was the only reason the Obama economy was actually riding high. Mm-hmm. Whereas places like New York and Los Angeles are actually losing money because their taxes are high and people are taking their business to places where it's easier to do.
Exactly. Business. So you have this concept in the U.S. of right-to-work states. Mm. Where essentially the unions are not able to dictate things like minimum wages. And if you look in terms of where the economic boom has been coming in the U.S., it's been particularly in those right-to-work states, which, you know, interestingly enough, are the states where Trump has been doing particularly strong. Mm. So to summarize effectively, if we get our heads out of the whole model of the nation state, and instead try to drill down to the smallest possible functioning units. And those functioning units are going to differ based on what the particular need is.
But then what happens to someone in, what does the place you mentioned, Bopalu earlier? What happens to those people?
They actually get on quite well right now without the injection of outside money. You know, there is nothing that actually makes you as resourceful as being in a place that has no resources whatsoever. So you take the case of Hong Kong, the world's most thriving democracy. They have zero resources. You take Israel, they're the middle of the fucking desert. Okay, and they made the desert bloom.
Yeah.
Humans are resourceful that way. You know, just give us a space where government gets out of the way and things work.
Let's talk about another story that's in the news that is about less resourceful people. The Congress of South African Trade Unions, who want workers' pension funds to be used to bail out Eskom because it believes this would yield investments in the long run.
Guys, that's theft. Flat out theft. It's no different to the politicians right now who are suggesting that we should use people's pensions to, you know, fund SOEs and other vanity projects, i.e. this policy of prescribed assets. The idea that you take from someone, you know, Here's the thing. The idea that you punish someone who's done the right thing, an employee somewhere, someone who worked their butts off, they stayed in a job, they saved, they scrimped, you know, someone who's looking forward to a restful retirement, the idea that you'll steal from that person in order to prop up people who maybe don't even care about being fiscally responsible. Why? Because they are deployed cadres and an SOE. Don't really care. They have a very sort of nonchalant relationship with money. Why? Because it just seems to miraculously come their way every year through bailouts. The idea that you're going to punish the saver, the doer, the guy who is responsible in society, to reward the kleptocrat, the corrupt, essentially the politically favored individual, is morally repugnant. Like, South Africans should be baying for blood on the street, so to speak. I don't mean that literally. But essentially, you know, we the citizenry should be saying, no, you don't get to steal from us.
Why is it we can muster such outrage for this kid at Parktown Boys who justifiably met an untimely death because of irresponsible adults?
Yes.
Right? It's easy for us to jump to and morally express outrage in a united sense as a nation, even if the nation state's rubbish, as Canton just detailed. But it is much harder for us to express the moral outrage that you're asking for when it comes to old people's pensions being taken away, stolen by thieves.
Mm. Well, I mean, you see this with VBS.
And the consequences of that are much more long-reaching.
Absolutely.
Much more wide-ranging, much more destructive.
I was about to say, you see this with VBS. We got a taste of it with VBS, where essentially politicians were caught red-handed with their sort of fingers in the cookie jar.
In the till, yeah.
But they then spent the next sort of months, if you will, going about doing the mental gymnastics required to say, well, you know, this wasn't that bad, really, because we just stole from poor people. And to a large extent, the broad public initially began by being very outraged. You know, the idea of stealing from the poorest of poor, somewhere in rural Limpopo. But, you know, the politicians sort of say, look, at least the money went here, it went there. But, hey, you know, maybe the NPA will eventually catch those individuals who did the worst of the stealing. Besides, we, the ANC, didn't steal as much as the EFF guys. And it became that sort of verbal gymnastics that sort of centered on irrelevant things. Why, I think? Because they're preparing you essentially for the bigger theft, which is actually because we've accepted morally that we did this to a few gokos in Limpopo somewhere, then you won't have a problem if we take from the rich individuals, right? But this time we do it because of charitable reasons. You know, we're taking from the rich to redistribute to the poor. Who are these poor people? Or the guys in SOEs? How are they poor? How are they poor? How does a poor person in Soweto right now feel like he has an ownership stake in Eskom, therefore would be quite okay with you stealing from him to prop up Eskom?
Yeah.
These are the sort of questions I think we need to be questioning and asking as South Africans, as we ask, really, what sort of society are we trying to build? One where the politicians continue to win, or one actually which I want, which is the individual and families, do the winning for a change?
Gareth, we're going to have Sihle back on this.
I know. I just want to go through one or two comments and then we'll wrap it up, but here's Kamu says, hi Sihle, I'm loving this. I'm a medical intern. I work at an NHI pilot hospital in East Rand. I see a lot of media and articles referring to how so-and-so will adapt to the NHI system, how private medical aid will function in the NHI, etc. Is embracing the NHI and assuming its implementation, whereas I see the NHI is completely ludicrous and a guise for just another organized looting operation.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I see so much positive media on the NHI?
Because the media don't live in the world of having to use public hospitals, by and large. And we don't even have the ability anymore to empathize and sympathize with poor South Africans who are relegated to that system. And also, by the way, to the officials who have to work in it. Because I do have sympathy for them too. Why? Because those individuals do not make decisions about how they do their jobs. Essentially, that decision making is centralized by, you know, either management that's put in place by politicians and, of course, the politicians themselves. The very people who don't use those very services. You see the same thing in education. The people making decisions around education are the very people who don't use the poor quality schools or even are anywhere near them in terms of using them as a service themselves. So I agree with you. I forgot the name. And again, in terms of the Big Daddy Liberty brand, these are the bad ideas that I'll be fighting, and I'll be trying to wage, if you will, the battle of ideas for good ideas. How do we actually build a property-earning, prosperous, and free society where everybody enjoys a high standard of living? You don't do that by centrally planned governments or empowering politicians.
Carl says it's such great frustration of mine that the Burning Platform isn't listened to by the ANC and SANEF, for example. Yes, well, we can't force the water, you know, the horse to the water and make it drink. Unfortunately. Just one last thing, and then I will release you two to go and do all the things that you do that are your real jobs. Can I please have, this is from Sean, an honest update on the impeachment farce? I seriously cannot find a sane take on this item, either from the left or the right-leaning press. Anything, brief.
Okay, the question right now is whether or not they actually allow witnesses into the hearing. And so,
especially John Bolton. He's gonna save the Democrats.
Well, I don't think it's a question of who the witnesses are. It's the principle of whether you actually allow another round of witnesses to be pulled into it. And of course, one of the trade-offs that they're trying to get is, yeah, we're willing to get you John Bolton if you give us Hunter Biden. And but what's interesting about that particular split is that even though we know that the senators are overwhelmingly going to not impeach Trump, they are divided on the question of whether or not there should be witnesses. And right now, in terms of the polling, it looks like there's roughly a 50-50 split. 50% say no witnesses. 50% say we want witnesses, which will be an interesting scenario, because in that case, the Chief Justice, who's presiding over this, John Roberts, is going to make the call in terms of whether or not there are witnesses. So that's the current state of play. You know, personally, I think that they should have witnesses, because
more information is always to be preferred.
Exactly. Yes. Your transparency is something that I support, and I particularly would like Joe Biden to be up there to answer questions about the fact that, you know, he claimed to know nothing about this oil company, but yet there's a picture of him and his son with the what is that company's name? I forget.
Burisma.
Yes.
Burisma.
Yes. But so yes, I would like all of them to be answering questions. But the executive summary for the person who asked the question is, we wait to see whether or not witnesses will actually be allowed.
Yep.
I see Alan Dershowitz is representing Trump.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Isn't he? I mean, he's a professor of law. Didn't he also do some work in the Weinstein defense? Or was it, am I getting... Oh, Epstein, sorry, the Epstein defense. Jesus, I'm getting my...
Get your Jews right.
I'm getting my pedophiles and my woman abusers mixed up. Thank you so much, both of you, for being part of the show this morning. And
can I just hop on something at that point, by the way?
Sure.
Let's stop calling the guy a pedophile, okay? He's a statutory rapist, which is a different thing from being a pedophile.
Fair enough. He's also dead.
Yes, I know, but I don't think
we have to worry about what we call him.
It's a question of terminology, and it's actually an important distinction.
I agree, Canton, and Epstein didn't kill himself. All right.
Yes, there we go. That's headphones off, mic down. Sitle Ngobese can be found on social media. Big Daddy Liberty's got his own show. If you liked what you heard here, you can always follow him. Pay attention to what he's doing, and we'll get him back for another episode soon. Seems like the comments from everybody are very favorable. They like you. One or two who absolutely detest you, but that's good.
Welcome to the show.
Yes, very good. So thank you very much, Canton. We will see the Burning Platform again next week, same time, same place, at 7 o'clock, bright and early, brought to you by Nando's. Never a lack of controversy and spice and peri-peri on this show.
Shout out to Kosher Nando's.
There we go. Kosher Nando's this morning. Very, very nice. CliffCentral.com.